Welcome to the Great Commission Today podcast, a podcast designed to help you and your church become more faithful, confident, and purposeful in obedience to the Great Commission. The Great Commission Today is sponsored by Five More Talents, an agency that offers holistic digital outreach solutions to help churches leverage technology wisely to invite more visitors, engage more members, and develop more leaders in this digital age.
All right. Well, it's good to meet with you today, Penny, and talk with you about the Great Commission.
Yeah.
And just to kind of start, I mean, you're one of my pastors, so I know a lot about you, but you know, most of the listeners here probably may not know hardly anything. So maybe just tell us a little bit about yourself and your family and the church and kind of what you do with your spare time. I know you have a lot of interesting interests. So
my name is John Penny Legion, but I go by Penny. Pretty much no one calls me John except for my family of origin or people who have never really met me. I have a wife named Kat. We've been married, we were married in 2003. So what does that put us at, like 22 years?
22 years.
Yeah, 22 years we've been married. Yeah. And we have three kids, a daughter named Lane, who is a freshman in college, a daughter named Mead, M-E-A-D, and she's a junior in high school, and then a son named Cole, who's a freshman in high school. So all of our kids were born not in Virginia. Lane was born in South Carolina, and then 2 weeks later, we moved to Missouri for me to go to seminary, and then Mead and Cole were born in St. Louis, where I went to seminary and served as an associate pastor for 7 years before coming to Christ the King in 2016, summer of 2016. I moved to Roanoke with my family to become the senior pastor here at Christ the King.
Has it really been almost 10 years?
Yeah, it'll be 10 years this summer. Yeah, it's wild.
Okay. Yeah.
It's pretty cool. And we love Roanoke. It's a wonderful place. It's been really great for our family. It's also, other than the city I lived in during college, this is the smallest city I've ever lived in.
Oh, wow.
But it's great. We love it. It's been a really, really wonderful place for us. I'm the senior pastor of Christ the King PCA Church in Roanoke, Virginia. And in my spare time, I like lots of things. I love baseball. You can see the bobbleheads. Bobbleheads behind me. So I'm a big baseball fan, St. Louis Cardinals fan. I also road bike. Cycle, which is my main form of exercise. I like to do that a few days a week. I also garden. Mm-hmm. Vegetable garden, and I like working in my yard and doing things with my hands, and those are, you know, I like reading, I like movies, I like TV, you know. So I feel like I've got a lot of interests. So maybe what's that phrase? You know, something of many, master of none, or whatever.
Right.
You know,
jack of all trades.
There it is. Yeah, jack of all trades, master of none. That's kind of sometimes how I feel a little bit.
I want to be as good of a gardener as you, though, when I grow up.
Yeah, it's fun. I like working in the yard for sure, and getting my hands dirty, and you know, having zucchini and tomatoes and growing things. It's really fun. So
it's awesome.
Yeah.
So I think you became a Christian more in college.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know a little bit more about, you've talked about it many times just in sermons, and heard some, and when we were in community group together a while back. But yeah, what just how did you come to know the Lord? What were some of the elements of that?
Yeah, so I didn't grow up going to church. Mm-hmm. That wasn't a part of our experience. And I actually remember very distinctively in college thinking religion, Christianity was foolish. It was kind of for people who couldn't accept reality, you know, as a way of like, yeah, just kind of trying to almost like anesthetize yourself to the problems of the world. It was an ancient thing for when people didn't know any better.
Mm-hmm.
It was for the ignorant. So that was my call, you know, my understanding in high school, how I appropriated religion. I didn't really know anyone who faithfully went to church. There was one girl in my high school that was kind of around in my popular friend group or whatever, you know, my group that I spent time with. And, but she partied with the rest of us. Like she went to the parties and drank and, but then she went to church on Sunday. And so she was mm-hmm. the only like religious person I knew. Mm-hmm. So then I went to college and, you know, kind of my life was very similar. It revolved around playing baseball, partying, you know, this is what I did. And, but I kind of like at times I would pick up the Bible and read it simply because I liked history and knowledge and mm-hmm. had a high school teacher who wasn't a believer say that the Bible was one of the best history books ever written.
Oh, wow.
So I would pick it up from time to time, but, you know, mm-hmm. I would start reading and I get somewhere into Leviticus and be like, this is, you know, I can't read this. I have no idea what's going on. So I always had kind of an interest because it was just general knowledge. But then I started attending a church in college because there was a girl that went to church and I was kind of interested in her. And so I started going and I started hearing the gospel and I made a profession of faith, but really my life never changed. Like I was still kind of just, it was just about the girl mm-hmm. until my junior year. I'd still been going to church and hearing the gospel and learning and, you know, I would pray and whatnot. But then my junior year, Thanksgiving of my junior year, it was a weekend of a lot of sin and debauchery, and I was mm-hmm. feeling very guilt-ridden. And the Sunday of that weekend, I was in my dorm room by myself praying because I felt so guilt-ridden. Mm-hmm. And I was very accusatory of the Lord. Like, mm-hmm. why would you let this happen to me? I had no problem believing in the sovereignty of God. That just made sense to me. So, you know, like, God, if you're in control, if you're powerful, why would you allow me to do the things I did this weekend, those sorts of things? And then finally, in a moment of that, I can only ascribe to the Spirit, you know, the Spirit's prodding. I basically prayed, Lord, have I done these things because my life hasn't been given over to you? I haven't been living for you. And, you know, I'm Presbyterian, so like what I'm about to say isn't normal for Presbyterians often, but in that moment, like I felt all the guilt just kind of fall away
mm-hmm.
And I didn't feel burdened by my guilt any longer in that moment. Mm-hmm. And so at the time I thought I was rededicating my life to the Lord. Mm-hmm. In reality, looking back, I can see like that was the time when I became a believer. Right. My life dramatically changed after that. Like I didn't party. I started doing Bible study. I started sharing my faith. I learned how to mm-hmm. pray. I got involved with a campus ministry and my life. Yeah. Like it can only be, the only thing that could account for that is the Lord changed me.
Yeah. Yeah. Praise the Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now you're a minister in a PCA church and yep. I'm just curious kind of along the way from, you know, your conversion, kind of to where you are today? Can you think of, some people that have discipled you along the way, or people that you've kind of were helpful to you and your growth that you kind of continue to look back at, and just kind of are thankful for kind of how they maybe helped you with particular things you were learning about the Bible, or, you know, how to live as a Christian, those kind of things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, initially, for sure, the campus ministry I got involved with, which was called Campus Outreach. There were a couple guys who were on staff with them that were on our campus. And they're the ones who taught me how to study the Bible, how to read the Bible, how to pray. They exposed me to different Reformed works. I remember we read one of the first books we ever read was The Disciplines of Grace by Jerry Bridges, or The Master Plan of Evangelism by Robert Coleman. John Piper was really influential over that ministry. So I read Desiring God. And so the campus ministers affiliated with Campus Outreach was, I mean, so, so significant in those early stages. But then also, like, there were pastors that were super influential. So a man named Archie Moore, who was the pastor of Greenwood Presbyterian Church in Greenwood, South Carolina, was the first pastor I ever had. And that, like, he is a man of prayer unlike any person I've ever met. So he would just constantly pray for me and for others. And I still see him about once a year, just through PCA connections. And so he was huge. That was influential in my life. And then when I moved to Greenville, South Carolina, to work on staff with Campus Outreach, I became a member of Mitchell Road Presbyterian Church. There were two pastors at Mitchell Road that were significant in my early Christian growth, a man named Randy Smith, who was the senior pastor, and then the assistant pastor, who's now the senior pastor at Mitchell Road, Andy Lewis. They just really, they influenced me in my theological knowledge, in my growth in kind of Reformed doctrine, but also in understanding kind of the like taking our Reformed theology and implementing it into our daily lives. So, like, Andy was awesome about that. He and his wife were super influential to me and my wife, Kat, in that they would talk to us just about how our theology informed our understanding of our emotions and interacting with family and friends and neighbors. And, and it was less about, like, it was very theological, but it was less about, like, getting all the right lingo down, and more about, like, how does this live out in our lives? And so those two men, Randy and Andy, really influenced me in those early days. And they're the ones who encouraged me to go to seminary.
Great. It sounds like they were more focused on applying the scriptures and theology to, like, relationally rather than.
You know, like, they were theological, like Andy, super, like, he could easily do a PhD in theology, but he's like, that's all well and good. Like, his favorite theologian, I remember, was John Owen. And I remember he said that he read somewhere that John Owen said, and I don't know if this is true or not, you know, I've never read this, but Andy swears that he read that John Owen said, if I could preach like John Bunyan, I would give up all my theological knowledge to be able to do that. And so when I heard that, I was like, you know, theology isn't supposed to just be about, like, this ivory tower, esoteric ideas. Like, what's important is the way it plays out in our lives.
We were just in the men's Bible study this morning at CTK. We were looking at Revelation 2 verses 1 through 7, the letter to the church in Ephesus. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of grappling with what does it mean that they had lost their first love? And we were talking about, you know, truth versus truth and grace. And the people at the church in Ephesus in that time, they were so committed to sound doctrine and were commended by that, by Jesus, but they had lost their first love. And so anyway, sounds like that was part of what these men were influential with you about.
For sure. Yeah.
So starting to transition into just looking at more of the Great Commission itself, but just to kind of set this in context, you know, just as you kind of think about, you know, your local church, our local church, our community, and just kind of ministry that you're involved in, be it in the presbytery or whatever, what are some ways that you see God at work in the local church and in the community?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, related specifically to the Great Commission, like evangelism.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. As you think about like the Great Commission and like what do you see going on just in your daily life, where, you know, where you are and where we are, what are some things that you see going on that you're thankful for?
Yeah. So I think, you know, I think there's kind of almost like two different ways that you can kind of appropriate evangelism, discipleship, outreach, that sort of thing. One is very kind of like programmatic, you know, there's a programmatic aspect to it, which like I'm not valuing or devaluing either. Mm-hmm. That's one emphasis. The other emphasis is often kind of like a, almost like a deinstitutionalizing of it. So it becomes much more like relational or organic, for lack of a better term. And I think that, I gravitate towards more the relational, deinstitutional approach mm-hmm. to like the Great Commission. And I guarantee you that's my, you know, campus ministry upbringing. Right. If you will. Yeah. so, you know, so often, but what that means is that oftentimes those, the way it plays out isn't like grand, or mm-hmm. it's not often on display for all to see. Yeah. That doesn't mean it's not happening. So for me personally, what that looks like then is, like I spend almost every day, every working day, half the day, not in my office.
Right.
I'm in the community. I'm often at a restaurant or a bar or someplace like that where mm-hmm. all the people around me are not believers.
Right.
And I'm getting to know them. I'm befriending them. It's taking time. You know, like there are people that I have been getting to know for, well, I've been here almost 10 years and I've known them for, you know, maybe like 5 or 6 of those years. And they know I'm a pastor, they know I'm a Christian, and our spiritual conversations are just starting now. Mm-hmm. So it's slow and methodical, and, you know, me basically showing them that I care about them because they're humans. Mm-hmm. It's not flashy, right? Like we're not doing like tent revival type stuff. Right. But the conversations that I'm starting to have and that have come about from this, like simply being faithfully present with them, listening, asking questions, like the conversations are starting to happen. Mm-hmm. And I see that with people in our church as well. Like there's a couple in our church that has shared with me how they've started having their neighbor over for dinner.
Yeah.
Grieving the loss of his wife, who he grew up Catholic, but they're having him over and they've had him over and they're having conversations about the gospel with him.
Yeah.
this man might never set foot in our church, or he maybe would have never set foot in our church apart from this couple, but because they're reaching out to him, because they're spending time with him, who knows what the Lord might do. So, so it's these, like, it's kind of more slow and less, there's less fanfare about it. And yet it's happening. And I kind of, I personally gravitate towards that a little bit more. So it's, and again, I'm, you know, if there are churches out there that are very, are much more programmatic, are much more like, let's have like invite your friend Sunday. I'm not opposed to those things. Right. It's just kind of not my bent. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So let's transition into actually talking about the Great Commission. So I'm going to just read that text, and then I'm just kind of curious to kind of just hear your kind of exegesis of it. So here it is, Matthew 28:16-20, ESV. So now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain which Jesus had directed them. And when they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. And Jesus came and said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And behold, I'm with you always to the end of the age." So how would you break this down so that we can make sure that we're understanding kind of all the key things that are going on in this this particular event that's recorded here?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I mean, a number of things I would say. So, like, one is Jesus is sovereign over this, right? Mm-hmm. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. So he's over it all. So in one sense, that's incredibly freeing, right? it's not up to me. And at the same time, because he is over all, then he has the authority, the power, and the right to direct what we're supposed to do, right? What are we supposed to do? Well, we go and make disciples of the nations. And I think that that language of make disciples, like, I think there's two aspects we want to think about. Like, make disciples means, it implies, one, that maybe there were people who weren't disciples, right? We're making new disciples. So there's an evangelistic aspect. But then also, I think making disciples includes kind of that sanctification, that growing in knowledge and awareness of what it means to follow Jesus, because he talks about teaching them to observe all that I've commanded you. So it's not just this idea of like, okay, go evangelize. Get a response and then you're done. You know? Like, I remember in my campus ministry days, Dawson Trotman, who was the founder of the Navigators, was super influential. And he wrote, there was a book called Dawes, D-A-W-S. It was his basically memoir, autobiography. And he talked about how for early in his Christian life, he would evangelize people. And once they made this profession of faith, he was like, awesome, let me move on to the next person. But then he started to run into a few of these people that he had evangelized and had made profession of faith. And then later in life, they clearly weren't walking with the Lord. And he realized that there was a discipleship aspect that needed to occur. And I think actually the Great Commission hits on both of these, right? So it's not simply get the profession of faith and awesome. You know, they've checked their ticket into heaven. We're good to go. But actually Jesus is saying, no, discipleship includes more than that. You know, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. So the Great Commission isn't just about evangelism. It's also about sanctification. It's about growth. So
Mm-hmm.
I would say it's both. Baptizing them, it's a setting apart, right? We have the important, the Trinitarian formula, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And then also, I think what's beautiful about the Great Commission is that, Jesus, not only does he have authority, but he also says, I'm with you. Like, I'm going with you in the midst of this. And that just brings to mind that passage in John where Jesus talks about, when you stand before the rulers of this age, the Spirit will give you words to say, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because Jesus is with us, right? So like,
right.
Part of, I think, the difficulty of evangelism and discipleship often is this fear of like, I'm not going to know how to answer this question.
Right.
I'm not going
right.
to know what to say, but if Jesus promises to be with us, then I still might not know what I should have said.
Right.
But I can have confidence that that he's working despite my inabilities.
Right.
Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think that the promise really is kind of, it's bookended, focusing on Jesus's authority. And then also it concludes with the promise that he is with us. And I think it's also just beautiful, as I've reflected on this over the years, what it says about the disciples before Jesus gives the commission. It says they worshiped him, so clearly they're worshiping him, but it says but some doubted. And that seems to connect to what you're saying about, hey, like we as disciples are we don't have it all together. We don't have it all figured out. And yet Jesus gives this commission to them. They are worshiping him, but some doubt it. I don't know if I'm interpreting that correctly, but that's kind of what you were saying
mm-hmm.
brought to my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right.
Yeah. Is there maybe one or two other
mm-hmm.
texts of scripture that maybe are complementary to the Great Commission that help us to maybe understand it and put it in its proper context?
Yeah, I think so. So like Acts 1 is like the Lucan version of the Great Commission, right? That's where Jesus says to his disciples, you will receive power when the Spirit comes upon you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the end of the earth, right? So that feels like a very complementary passage to Matthew 28 about like, the gospel is to go forth, right? It begins in this like beachhead of Jerusalem, but it goes into the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then the other passage that I often think about comes from 1 Peter 3. And this is where Peter says, in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. For it is better to suffer for doing good, if that should be God's will, than for doing evil. But that, verse 15 is kind of that focal point of, being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for the reason for the hope that is in you. So being ready to talk about what makes us different.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like what is it that that makes us unique? And that passage in 1 Peter, I think, is really fascinating to me because it implies that our lives are lived in such a way that people would say, like, there's something different.
Right.
Right. Like, what is the hope that is, what is the reason for your response to whatever it might be? And being ready to tell them,
mm-hmm.
And so I just think that that's a really beautiful passage, especially because Peter is living in a very, in a time, in a place that is very contrary to the gospel, right? Like, he's writing and living, he's writing to a people and living in a time that was hostile to the gospel. And what does he say? Live in a way that your hope is presented to others so that they would ask. And when they ask about your hope, you can go, oh, it's really not about me. It's about Jesus. Like, the only reason I'm living this way is because the gospel has changed my life. And to me, that feels very much like declaring to the world, you know, what Jesus has done. He's changed me.
Right.
he's transformed me, you know. That to me feels very much like the Great Commission being worked out.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, because it gets to that that part of the Great Commission of teaching them to observe whatsoever he commanded you. If someone is, by God's grace, doing that, then their lives are going to be different. And so, you know, people will see that hope. So you were talking a little bit about, we're transitioning now to kind of talk a little bit more about the application of the Great Commission today. So you're talking a little bit about the environment in which Peter was writing. And I'm curious kind of what similarities and differences you see between that, you know, first century AD Mediterranean world and today. Obviously, it's the 21st century North America. There's some things that are different, but I'm curious what you see as some of the similarities and differences.
Yeah. So, you know, some of the similarities, I think, are that I think that we should perceive ourselves the way that the apostles perceive themselves, and that is as exiles.
Okay.
That this is not our home. That's what Peter says in 1 Peter 1 to the exiles, right? That's who he's writing to. And I think that that's actually an important thing that we need to think about, because I think very often we think that we are living in Jerusalem when in reality this is Babylon. So I just think that that's how we should perceive ourselves. Like, we are those who are going to face opposition and misconception and misunderstanding and perhaps persecution. Like, this is who we are, just as they were. And that's exactly what Jesus said, right? Like, we will face tribulation, right? So I think that, I think 1 Peter is actually an incredibly helpful book for us, because it reorients us to who we are and what is our cultural circumstance. So I think there's a lot of similarities there. I also think, like, a lot of similarities, and, you know, other people are way more articulate and have written much more about this than I have, but that we have more similarities now in America to the original, you know, time of the writing of the New Testament than maybe any other time in America's history, that we are actually more akin to, like, a pre-Christian sort of environment. So, you know, and for, like, personally, like, I grew up in Canada. I already just said, like, I didn't know a single believer, like, true believer growing up. And so, like, that's not a scary proposition for me. Like, I'm like, well, of course we're a minority. and maybe we actually always were, but because the, and, you know, historically, I'm not, you know, I was a history major, but I didn't really focus on American history or American religion, you know, so I could be wrong in this, but it seems to me like maybe the Christianity of America hasn't always actually been true Christianity, but more kind of culturally oriented. And so maybe true Christianity was always kind of a minority. Perhaps. I don't know that for sure.
Yeah.
But the fact that I do think that we're living in a time where we are more marginalized, maybe, mm-hmm. or ignored, or we mm-hmm. have less cultural power.
Right. Right.
Tells me that, like, I was actually just having lunch with a friend of mine who I haven't seen in probably 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to live in Colorado. He now lives on the eastern shore of Virginia. But when he lived in Colorado, he told me that his city in Colorado, this small town, had a large Wiccan population.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And on the highway, there would be billboards that would say, keep religion out of politics.
Oh, wow. Like,
these were on the billboards in Colorado.
Yeah. Wow.
So, so this, you know, that sounds to me very similar to first century Greco-Roman world.
Right.
So I think, you know, in those ways, we're very similar.
Yeah.
I also think at the same time where, you know, people are open to having spiritual conversations. Like, I've had conversations with my neighbors who are not believers, who are open to talking about religion and spirituality and hearing about my understanding of the world and Christianity. And they're not offended by that.
Right. Yeah.
They're open to discussing it. So similarly, like I think about in Acts 17, when Paul's invited to talk about Christianity at the Areopagus, right at Mars Hill, mm-hmm. There was an openness to dialogue. I feel yeah. like that might be more so now than maybe in previous times. But of course, there's differences, right? Like, we have unique situations. You know, like, I would just say technology is
right,
you know, yeah. like that. So in one sense, that can be a terrifying proposition, you know, the way that technology is influencing our cultural moment. But at the same time, it could be an opportunity, because what we're seeing is almost this, like, I don't know how to describe it, but it's like there's a lack, there's a shared vernacular and experience regardless of where you are in the country. So, like,
nice.
My kids, right? Like, my kids, 6, 7, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with this, 6, 7, you know, this is like an internet.
This is news to me. Okay.
It's an internet phenomenon. I mean,
okay.
But in Roanoke, Virginia, 6, 7. Yeah. LA, 6, 7. Like, they're all doing it.
Okay.
So there's almost this, like, universalizing right. of experience
yeah.
that wasn't there before.
Interesting. Yeah.
So we can speak the same language. We can refer to the same cultural qualities. And mm-hmm. whether you're in Roanoke, whether you're in New York City, whether you're in Birmingham, Alabama, like, you've been exposed to these things, which allows mm-hmm. for opportunity that maybe wasn't there before.
Yeah. I could even see that extending internationally to some extent as well.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, no yeah. doubt. So, like, yeah, you know, people are listening to the same music in other countries.
Yeah. Yeah.
As we are, and watching the same movies. And so now, of course, there's still differences. There are still yeah. unique things about particular pockets of a country or internationally, but there's greater exposure, which opens,
right.
which provides greater opportunity as well.
Yeah, I had never thought about that aspect of the technology that we have today, but yeah, I could, that's a really good example. I can see that how that is part of what's happening. So,
yeah.
I was just thinking of in college, I was on a mission trip in Tanzania one time, and it was interesting to see which American celebrities, people there, latched onto, and it was in this particular place where I was. It was Chuck Norris, and it was Chuck Norris nice. And Michael Jackson. So
yeah, awesome. That's really funny. Yeah.
All right. So as far as applying the Great Commission, what are your thoughts on as individuals and households on the one hand, and then corporately as a local church on the other hand? So what are some things that we should be thinking about maybe as individuals and households? And then maybe what are some things we should be thinking about as churches?
Yeah, I mean, and this goes back to kind of my default of kind of more relational aspects, right? So as individuals and households, I think it comes down to like, who are the people in your social spheres? Who are the people you know? Who are the people, who are your neighbors? Like, I remember talking to a man, this was maybe like 9-ish years ago, and they were talking about like the idea that everybody is my neighbor. You know, so like everyone's my neighbor. And so that means the homeless person downtown is my neighbor. I'm like, absolutely. Like they're your neighbor. And so is your neighbor. So like, I hope in your apartment complex, you actually know the name of your neighbor. And he was like, you know, I'm like, dude, you're right there. Like you have people who need the gospel who live right beside you, not just like 15 minutes down the road, right? So I think for like individuals, for families, it begins with like, who do you know? Who are you interacting with? Like, who are the families that your kids are playing sports alongside of? Who are the, who, you know, like, my kids are in public school. And when we first moved here, my wife's motto was my kids are at public school. So I'm in public school. So she volunteered in the library at the public school. And she was in, you know, walking the halls like at least once a week. And she got to know teachers and aides and, you know, some of whom were believers, some of whom were not, you know. And so it begins there, I think. And then, you know, inviting them into your home. So we've had people into our home who are definitely not Christians.
Right.
And, you know, what's interesting is like, even there's this one woman I can think of who, you know, she's a lesbian, mm-hmm. and is not a believer. And she had to have a surgery and had nowhere to live after her surgery. Mm-hmm. She needed someone to take care of her. And so she slept on our couch. Mm-hmm. She was in our home. And I remember her asking me to pray for her before her surgery. And I said, that's fine. You know, I am praying to Jesus. Like that is what I believe, right? Like, I just want you to be very clear. Like, I'm not just praying to like unicorns and rainbows here.
Right,
like,
right. Yeah.
I believe in a particular God who calls us to a particular way of life. And so, you mm-hmm. know, she was in our life, and you know, since then we've kind of, you know, lost touch, but still, like, it was just, this is a person who's in our life, so we want to be in her life. Mm-hmm. Where do we overlap? Where can we bring the gospel to bear in our relationship? So that's where I think it begins with like families and individuals, helping our kids to see that. Like, mm-hmm. do our kids know any non-believers? Like, that would be the first question, actually, I'd ask anyone. Do you know any non-Christians?
Right.
And yeah. Do your kids know non-Christians?
Right, right.
And then, like, as far as a church goes, again, you know, I'm not a big program guy. You know, we're, mm-hmm. you know, that like, we've yep. never had Revival Sunday. You know, I think are we cultivating in a posture in our church where the non-believer could arrive and they're going to feel welcomed, but they're also going to hear the truth.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have non-Christians who do attend our worship service. Mm-hmm. Some of whom have shared with me how they don't like how friendly our church is.
Okay.
They're like, I can't get in or out without someone talking to me, you know? And I'm like, well, that's good, you know? I think that's wonderful. But so, you know, where they're going to hear the gospel, but they're also going to see the hospitality of Jesus. And, you know, statistically, I forget where I saw this, but statistically, the greatest likelihood of someone coming to church is that a friend invites them, not a pastor, and not them just driving by, but like a neighbor.
Yeah.
Saying, why don't you come with me?
Yeah. I've seen that in Lifeway research. As what stood out to me is it's somebody inviting their friend or acquaintance or neighbor versus an ad or something like that.
Right. Yeah. And so, but then like once they come into the door, are we a church that one notices the new person, goes and greets them and welcomes them, and no matter what comes out of their mouth, we go, we're glad you're here. Right. Yeah. Like, because there are sometimes like crazy things that people, you know, they'll, you know, it's just crazy things that are reasons why they're here. But like, do we go, you know, I don't have to correct that right this moment. I can simply say, I'm really glad you're here.
So, that's great. So what do you think are, some of the common obstacles that people face as we, this is one of the reasons why I'm excited about doing this podcast, because I continue to have a desire to grow in obedience to the Great Commission, but I also am like, I see, you know, obstacles. I see like problems. So what do you think are some of the, what are some of the things that you've found that you see that people often run into as they?
I think, and these are things that not only do I see in other people, but I see in myself at times as well. So like, I'm not just saying, like, this is a problem for other people and I've got this solved. Right? But I think a few things. One is, I mean, it's fear, right? Like fear of man. Like if I say I believe in Jesus, they might think I'm, you know, I've lost my mind. Right. Like, you know, maybe they're going to think basically I believe in unicorns and elves and stuff. Right. Like that's how they're going to perceive of me and not like intellectual or intelligent or reasonable.
Yeah.
So I think that there's that aspect.
Yeah.
I also think, and I think actually this is more significant than the first thing. But it's this idea that I have to be able to answer every question that they have in such a way that it like, it just like solves the problem for them. And so I think for a lot of people, they're like, well, what if they ask me something I don't know the answer to?
Right.
So I don't want to enter into that conversation and then have to say, I don't know, or that's a great, great question. And I can't answer, you know, like, and, so I think that kind of meant that thinking of like, I have to be able to solve their intellectual inquiry in that moment. But you know, that's actually where being reformed is super helpful and free.
Okay. Yeah.
Because Jesus says, I will be with you and all authority is granted me. And then Paul says like, I water, you know, I forget what it was, Apollos watered and I planted, or I planted and he planted, whatever. Yeah. But the point is God made the growth, right?
Right. Yeah.
So like, I've never heard anyone who came to faith go, man, I came to faith because whoever it was that I was talking to could answer every question I had. Right. Like that doesn't happen.
Right.
So it's actually really freeing to be able to say, you know, I just don't know.
Yeah.
Or that's a really good point, and I don't have a great response to it, but this is what I know, or this is what I believe, or this is what I've experienced.
Right. Yeah.
So I think sometimes we kind of get ourselves in this like pit of what if I get asked something and I don't know the answer? And
it's kind of like a pride. I mean, it's kind of fear, but it's also kind of a pride in a way.
Yeah, I think so. And like not wanting to look foolish, right? Like, what if I say, I don't know? And to the person who's asking the question, that is the linchpin, right? Like, you know, like, how is that God would allow? Well, I had this conversation with someone actually online whose brother died. He was killed in like a car accident. He had a wife, a couple of young kids. And he was like, how is it that you can say God is good in the midst of that? And that he loves when like all his family is feeling is grief and sadness. And what I can, you know, in that moment, I can't go, well, this is how the Lord's going to use all these things. Cause I don't know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
All I could say was, I don't know. But what I do know is this, like Jesus meets us in our grief. He weeps with us in our sorrow. That he will one day defeat death finally, so that we will never feel it again. That he is going to wipe out. Like, this is what I do know.
Right. Yeah.
So this is the hope that I cling to, even when there are things I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that that has to be a sufficient answer for us. But I think sometimes we feel like maybe that's not enough. So I think those are things that hinder us sometimes.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah. I also, one more thing, Daniel, is I think sometimes we feel like if we don't share the whole gospel in one conversation, then it wasn't worth it almost. You know? So right. Like, I better walk them through the entire bridge diagram or Romans road,
right,
because this might be my only shot.
Right.
And you know, I've only got like 3 minutes.
Yeah. Right.
So I think sometimes that can hinder us when it's like, if you have a relationship with this person, then you can trust that, you know, there will be another conversation, or maybe I won't have another conversation, but someone else will.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey there. I'm Daniel Voss, co-founder and CEO of Five More Talents. And I wanted to take a moment to thank you for listening to the Great Commission Today podcast. I pray that each and every episode, including today's, blesses you and equips you and helps you to feel more confident, more purposeful, and to be more faithful in making disciples of all nations wherever the Lord has placed you. I also wanted to offer a special invitation to you if you're a church leader. If you're a church leader and you have the opportunity to use online outreach at your church and you're a decision maker in that role, and you sense that your church is just not grasping all the opportunities that you could to make more disciples and invite more visitors using the online media, then I'd love to talk with you. You can book a free 30-minute meeting with me called an outreach discovery call. In that meeting, we'll talk about what you've been doing and begin to explore some of the additional possibilities that are out there for you. So that sounds like that would be helpful to you. Just go to go.fivemoretalents.com and fill out the form there. Now back to the interview. All right. So talking about practical next steps. I know you've talked about how what you gravitate towards is more of an organic type approach to things, and just kind of seeing how things grow organically, right? So I'm curious, though, for those that are wanting to, you've already mentioned a number of different things. I guess this is really more specifically for a local church, more on that sort of scale, more so than than the individuals and households is what I'm asking about. So, you know, a lot of the, many of the churches that I work with at Five More Talents are in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church denomination. And in their church planting manual, there's a distinction between outreach and evangelism. And so I wanted to ask you a few questions about that. Okay. So the church planting manual defines outreach as, quote, any gospel activity or ministry which brings the work of the church before the people of the community in which the congregation ministers. So it's talking about outreach as bringing the work of the church, as opposed to the way they define evangelism as actually bringing the righteous requirements of God and his plan of salvation before the people of the community. So I grew up in an OPC church, so I can sort of say, ha ha, this is perhaps like a very fine distinction. but at the same time, there's maybe, I think there might be some useful insights in it. So I'm just kind of curious if you have any thoughts on just that distinction between outreach and evangelism. Is it, in what ways is it possibly helpful?
Yeah. Well, first, I had never seen this until you sent it to me. Okay. So I had no idea this was part of the OPC's, I guess, philosophy of ministry, if you will.
Yeah, it's part of the church planting manual that they published in 2000. Okay. Yeah.
And I actually really like it in many ways, because I do think there is a distinction. Like, so think about like works of mercy. So like, I think about our deacons and the works of mercy that they oftentimes are involved in. You know, a man or a woman comes and they need food. Mm-hmm. Their power is going to get, it's starting to get cool and it's going to get cold soon in Roanoke. And so people are going to have, you know, they could be in danger of having their power turned off. And that's like a legitimate danger, right?
Right.
So they come to us and they say, like, how can you help? Can you help? Will you help? Please help, right? And so those works of mercy, I think, are those gospel activities that aren't evangelism.
Right.
They are an overflow of what we believe about the gospel, though they're not necessarily sharing the gospel.
Right.
And I think that they can lead to conversations about the gospel.
Right.
So yeah. Like, why do we care about our fellow man? Like, it's not because our fellow man's easy to care about. Like, apart from the gospel, I don't care. Like, if we're being perfectly honest, apart from the gospel, there is no reason why I should care about the well-being of my neighbor. Mm. That is a borrowed understanding of the Christian belief of love. Now, I'm really thankful that non-believers care about their neighbors. So don't hear what I'm not saying. But this is just an outworking of what we already believe, right? So we care about our, you know, so acts of mercy, I think, are really helpful because they are demonstrations of us caring for our neighbor.
Right.
And they're also not the proclamation of the gospel.
Right. Yeah.
They could lead to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they're not necessary. So that's why I actually like this kind of.
Yeah. It's talking.
It gets kind of wordy a little bit, but it's very technical, very, I mean, it feels in keeping with the OPC in many ways, which I really appreciate. I like it. So making those distinctions, I think, is helpful.
Yeah.
It's talking
about bringing the work of the church, right, before the people of the community.
Yeah. So, you know, like thinking about a number of weeks ago, a number of members of our church went and built beds for kids in our community who don't have beds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not evangelism.
Right.
But that's, I would say that's the work of ministry.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, So, and you know, we might never get to share with the kid who gets to sleep in one of those beds the right. gospel, but
yeah.
but they're going to know that a church is the one who built that for them.
Yeah, and it's really interesting that you say that, because some of the reading I've done in preparing for these podcasts is looking at I don't know if you've how much you've read about William Carey, the Baptist preacher, a missionary from the 1700s, and kind of he ended up kind of starting what many credit him as starting the modern mission movement. But as I went back and read some of the sermons from around that time, of course they were talking about, hey, like there's people in other parts of the world that need to hear the gospel. And they were also saying, you know, we just believe as Christians, we're supposed to be generally benevolent to the people around us because of who God is. Like God loves, R.C. Sproul kind of articulated as there's, God has a love of benevolence for all people, right? He causes his rain to fall on the just and the unjust. So anyway, that was just kind of a brought to mind as you were saying that.
Yeah. So we want to, you know, like, I mean, the classic example is the parable of the Good Samaritan, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like he loved his neighbor, he cared for him, provide for him, bandage them, you know, mm-hmm. all that. So those are works of ministry. And we also, so we need that. And I think that that's actually where the church can oftentimes be really good, right? Like can be helpful to our community. And then there's the work of evangelism, which is the mm-hmm. proclamation of the gospel.
Right.
Oftentimes those things are tied together, but they're not always, right? Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So just getting really nitty gritty, I'm going to just kind of get your hot takes on some outreach methods and then some evangelism methods and just kind of your just hot takes, opinions of like,
sure.
That's awesome. We should do more of that. Like, that's dumb. We should not do that. That kind of thing. Okay. So
okay.
As far as outreach, again, we're drawing from the OPC Church Planting Manual. It talks about really four types of outreach ministries. First one's advertising. Secondly, newsletters. Third, public meetings. So like a conference or like a Vacation Bible School might fall into that. And then the fourth one being the publishing of sermons and teaching. So I'm just kind of curious, like, just what's your sense of what's helpful, what's maybe more helpful and what's maybe less helpful as far as church outreach, advertising, yeah. newsletters, public meetings, publishing sermons and teaching.
Yeah. What's helpful, what's not. I mean, you know, do people get newsletters anymore that they don't subscribe to? that feels maybe a little dated to me, right? Or like the flyer that I might get in my mailbox around Easter. You know, it's like, I never look at it. I'm a believer and I never look at it. Like, is my non-believing neighbor going to look at that? You know? So I'm like, I don't know. I'm always a little skeptical of that, you know, just that kind of like, hey, we're going to put out a mailer and we'll see who comes. Now, maybe that works, you know, maybe I just haven't heard a lot of that. Mm-hmm. But I'm not opposed to it. Like I would never say, if someone said, hey, we'll give you $5,000 to like blanket the city with an invite to Easter, I wouldn't say no. but it just makes me wonder, like, if we send it out to 1,000 people, would we get 10?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the answer to that. So I'm not opposed to it. I just don't want to put all my eggs in that basket. So I'm open almost to trying almost anything that's going to allow the gospel to go out, mm-hmm. as long as it's ethical and, you know, in keeping with right. the gospel, of course. But, right. So, you know, we have people who have come to VBS, Vacation Bible School, And I'll ask them, you know, how did you show up? You know, why'd you come? And they said, we saw the sign on the road. Do you go to a church? Nope. I was looking for something for my kid, something safe, something to do.
Yep.
And we saw the sign.
Saw the sign.
Okay. You know, so we had of the like 80 kids, maybe two of them were because of that.
Wow.
That sign took nothing to put out there. You know, it was a little bit of money. We just stuck it. So like I'm open to those things. I just don't think that we should think at the end of the day that's gonna cover it. That's all.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. So with that, as far as like paid advertising, is that kind of how you would think about that as well?
Yeah. I mean, again, I would be open, you know, I'm not opposed to it, you know, Facebook mm-hmm. ads, that kind of stuff. Like, I think it's interesting, Daniel, like we've done, what's it called? The evangelism program.
Christianity Explored.
We've done that twice.
Mm-hmm.
The one time we advertised, you helped us advertise for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We got a handful of people who have never been at our church. The second time we did, we didn't do any advertising and we got like no one.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. Mm-hmm. No, it's not like the first time we had like 50 people showing up.
Right.
Yeah. We had like five, but still it just points to, you know, maybe there's a place for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think like, that's where it's like, you know, is that our version is showing up at the area, you know, hotel?
Right.
Maybe.
Right.
So why not try it? And if it works, it works. If it doesn't work, what do you lose? You lost a little bit of money and some time, but mm-hmm. that's okay.
Yeah.
So.
And then this is getting really nitty gritty, but as you think about like church budgets and so forth, how do you think about that? Like, should churches be, like, I saw some research that said that a healthy church should be spending 10 to 20% of their budget on outreach and evangelism or something like that. I'm just kind of curious, obviously stewardship is involved.
Sure.
But I guess it's kind of, what are some of the principles that churches should be thinking about as they kind of, decide, like, should we invest some money? Is this more of like investing our time? Is this investing our money? Like, yeah, I'm just kind of curious how you think about that.
Yeah. I'm, like, I'd be, when I read that, when you sent it to me, my first thought was like, I wonder what that means. Like 10 to whatever percent towards outreach, you know?
Right.
Like, yeah. When we say outreach, what are we talking about? Like, are we talking about supporting, you know, a local ministry that's doing
right.
it? Or are we talking about like, we ourselves are, you know, fun, mm-hmm. you know? So I don't know exactly what that means. I'm like, if I'm of the persuasion, generally speaking, if someone's got an idea and we can find money for it, why not try it?
Mm-hmm.
As long as we have a reason, as long as we don't have a reason to say no.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone came to me and said, like, I've got this idea, like, you know, so we're doing this, we're having this classical music concert next mm-hmm. month at our church. We're hosting it. It's, you know, they're going to play hymns. They're going to, mm-hmm. you know, and it's all with harp and cello and, you know,
beauty. Yeah.
Does that count as outreach? I don't know. You know,
right.
I mean, there's no gospel presentation going to happen,
right.
but there's a possibility people will set foot on our property that normally wouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah, they'll see. They'll see. I would say it's a pretty soft form of outreach. I would say it's a form of outreach because they're stepping foot in the church building. They are seeing the welcome packets. They're maybe seeing some of the literature that might be sitting out. They might pick it up and flip through it if they're anyway, there's a number of different things that they could go beyond simply like, oh, nice building. Yeah.
Right. Or like we have, you know, we have a basketball goal in our parking.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, one reason why we put that up was because our youth pastor at the time loved basketball. And that was a way to play basketball with the youth of our church. But the number of kids from our neighborhood who come over and play basketball, which has led to opportunities for people in our church to talk to them.
Yep.
Like I heard the other week after service, there were these maybe five or six kids who were had not attended worship Sunday morning. They were from our neighborhood. They just walked over, they had a basketball and they're going over and playing. And I heard, I don't know who it was, but one of our elderly women went and talked to them and they're like hugging her, you know, like,
oh.
I don't know if she talked about the gospel. I don't know if she invited them to church, but what I do know is that they felt welcomed on our property.
Yeah.
Now there have been, we've had at least a couple of kids who first step foot on our property to shoot baskets, eventually come to worship.
Yeah.
So we spent money. We spent thousands of dollars putting in a basketball goal. So I'm like, you know, when our youth pastor mentioned that and he's like, what if we did a basketball tournament and did other things? I was like, great, let's try it. If all we lose is a few thousand dollars and we gain nothing from it, it was worth a try. So if, you know, I don't know what percent goes to outreach and evangelism, but I think why wouldn't we spend money?
Yeah. What I'm hearing is that there's, you know, a willingness of taking, you know, reasonable calculated risks and experimenting and, you know, just this, we're not having a preconceived notion of like, all, you know, we should only do this. We should never try these other things.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So you mentioned, you know, the young people playing basketball, and that's gets to one of the things I wanted to ask you about, which is this research that I don't know if you've seen from Pew Research. They're constantly releasing these studies, but as of 2023, which I guess is a couple of years ago, but that's the most recent data that they have. They said 44% of 18 to 29 year olds in the U.S. identify themselves as religiously unaffiliated, atheists, agnostics, or nothing in particular. And this is roughly equal to the number of people in that basically Gen Z, I guess it's Gen Z. Basically, it's roughly equal to the number of people in that age group that profess to be Christians. And it's the number of religiously unaffiliated 18 to 29 year old is up from 25% in 2007. So the number has increased considerably to now where like, if you're just out and about in the community, you meet someone who's 18 to 29, flip a coin, they're a professing Christian, flip a coin, they are like, I'm nothing. So have you seen evidence of this just in people that you know? And how should we be responding to that?
Yeah, I mean, so these, I don't, you know, I mean, trust Pew, they've done the research. If they say this, that, you know, that sounds reasonable to me. It sounds probable, you know? So I would say that. Then the other thing I would probably say is like, I don't interact a ton with this particular demographic personally. This is not, and our church doesn't, like, this is basically college and young professionals.
Right. Yeah.
We're not a college town. Generally speaking, we seem to attract more the like young family than the young single.
Right. Yeah.
So I don't have a ton of interaction, but where I do have the interaction with this group is actually at the bar that I frequent. Most of the bartenders fall into this age group.
Right.
And I think that that sounds pretty accurate, because I don't think a single one of them would profess to be a believer. Many of them I know have church experience and they've walked away.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems pretty consistent to me, at mm-hmm. least from that small mm-hmm. sample size.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my interacting with them, what I'm trying to do is give them a picture of, I mean, to us, it's just being faithful. It's just being ourselves, but like giving them an alternative understanding of what Christianity is, because all they see is the caricatures,
mm-hmm.
or they've experienced the caricature in reality. It's not a right. caricature to them.
Mm-hmm.
What we think is a caricature is what they actually have lived with and experienced mm-hmm. in their life. And so I'm trying to give them an alternative of like, no, mm-hmm. this is what like a real, what biblical Christianity actually looks like.
Right. Right.
Before I ever even talk to them about the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to ask them questions. I'm going to listen to them. I'm going to be patient with them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take interest in their life. Like, it's just normal. Like for us, this is like how we treat everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But to them, that's not their experience. What they've experienced with the church is judgment.
Right.
I have,
well, you mentioned,
I have tattoos, or one, I remember one man I talked to a number of times who he might be in his 30s now. So he mm-hmm. might be just outside of this generation, but you know, he's like, oh yeah. I mean, basically, what I remember of the church is they took every opportunity to ask for my money.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you know, at my church, we don't even do an offering during the service.
Right.
And he could not believe that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, you should come sometime. Like, mm-hmm. if the passage talks about money, we'll talk about money. And other than that, there's an offering box outside. If you come and visit, you want to give, you can give. If you don't want to, I'll never know. But you're welcome to come anytime. But all he thought he associated with the church was greed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm trying to give him like, no. Okay, I know that was your experience. I hate that was your experience. But that is not all that the church is.
Right.
There's another, and what I would say is a more biblically faithful expression of the church that has nothing to do with how much money you give.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's almost like trying to counteract their caricatures.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned asking questions, and just it made me think about how often in the Gospels Jesus is asking questions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, just, you know, Penny, as we wrap up today, just what's a, you know, word of exhortation on the one hand, that you would give to us, but then a word of encouragement. What's a word of exhortation and a word of encouragement?
Yeah. I thought about this. This is, I don't know. I think, you know, I think I'll start with the word of encouragement, because I think that that's what gives us the motivation for the exhortation. So the encouragement is like, the Lord's going to build his church.
Yeah.
Promise that, right? Like, his church shall never perish. That's what we sing. The church is one foundation, right? The church will never perish. Jesus has promised that. Like, we know who wins, and it's Jesus. And so his church wins. So that's incredibly comforting to me. And that actually allows me to be able to say with confidence, I believe in Jesus and his death and resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
And not in my good moments, not be worried what people might think about me saying that.
Mm-hmm.
So the encouragement of like, we already know the end. Jesus is won. It's like that, that's a good place to be, right? It's a great place to operate out of. And so then the exhortation coming out of that is then we can be bold with the gospel. Mm-hmm. And we can be confident in, you know, the relationships that the Lord has given us. Mm-hmm. And we can be, we can ask him to provide opportunities and then to equip us for those opportunities when they arise. Mm-hmm. And so for us to step out in faith, like, I think that's what I would say, like the encouragement gives us the strength, the boldness, mm-hmm. to be able to share with people the hope that is in us.
Yeah.
And so not to, you know, not to shy away from that. Yeah, not to shy away from it, but to know that the Lord's with us, even when, you know, like, I just think about this First Peter passage, right? We present the hope that is in us with gentleness and respect. That's what he mm-hmm. says. Mm-hmm. But then he says, so that when you are slandered, you're going to get slandered. Right. Those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. When are they going to be put to shame? Well, it's in the end. Mm-hmm. We're not put to shame. Like, in the end, Jesus will look at us and go, you know, you were faithful. Well done. Mm-hmm. And so I think that because we know that gives us, it equips us to go out mm-hmm. and not be afraid of the shame that might come mm-hmm. or the reviling that might come, because Jesus doesn't revile us.
Yeah. Very good. Yeah. I mean, it makes a big difference to, you know God's promises and to know of his love for us, his plan that he's carrying out. So.
Yeah. And, you know, Daniel, like, I think sometimes, like, I see it with people, you know, because we're living in a time that feels like transition as far as like the appreciation of Christian virtue in our time. You know, like, there's a decrease, it feels like, of an appreciation of Christian virtue. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I think a lot of people are shocked and surprised, but yet the Apostle Paul said we are the aroma of life to some, those mm-hmm. who are living, but right. we're also the aroma of death mm-hmm. to those who are dying. And like, that can't smell good.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So in one sense, like, we shouldn't be shocked that there would be people who would revile us.
Right. Yeah.
I think far too often we are shocked by that.
Right. Yeah.
And that doesn't mean, like, you know, so I think that the way that we sometimes respond is, well, we just got to make it as palatable as possible. Mm, that's right, not the response. Right. Yeah. We still say the truth. Mm-hmm. But we also are not, we say the truth out of a desire that what they would eventually smell is life. Mm-hmm. Right. And that they'd be brought to life. So anyway,
very good. Well, thank you so much, Penny, for being taking out of your time today and just talking with me and talking with our listeners about this great topic of the Great Commission. So thank you again.
Yeah, very fun. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Great Commission Today podcast. If this has been helpful to you, please subscribe, share with your friends, and leave a review.
He is given to me. Jesus came and said, just before he went to heaven, he commanded them, go therefore and do what I've told you. He said, go therefore and make disciples, and when it's all complete, I'll come for you. He said, lo, I am with you always. Go to all the world. Go to all the world.